Xin chào mọi người và chào mừng đến với KNKB Podcast. Chương trình hôm nay sẽ phát bằng tiếng Anh. Hy vọng các bạn thưởng thức chương trình. Xin chào tất cả mọi người và chào mừng đến với Không Nói Không Biết thảo luận Chủ nhật ngày hôm nay. Chúng ta hôm nay sẽ nói về khía cạnh khác nhau của các cảnh sát. Buổi thảo luận hôm nay sẽ bằng tiếng Anh. Mong là các bạn thưởng thức chương trình. Hello everyone, welcome to the KNKB Sunday discussion. Today we're going to talk about different aspects of the police reforms after the indictment of ex-officer Chauvin following a year-long protest of the Black Lives Matter movement. Here with me today is Associate Dean and Director Tim Vu. Unfortunately, due to some personal reasons, Representative Samantha won't be able to join us today, but hopefully we can see her beautiful faces in the upcoming live streams. A little bit of background about Tim Vu. Tim is an accomplished senior law enforcement professional with more than 25 years of leading investigation in security, public service, and police force activity. He has served as detective to police chief of the Alhambra Police Department. And now he is the associate dean and director for the Golden West College. Mr. Vu graduated from the California State University with a bachelor in criminal justice and law enforcement administration, and even got his MBA from the University of Redlands. I hope everyone is here to give him a very warm welcome. Dr. Tim, did you want to say anything else?
Well, first off, I want to thank you for the introduction and thank you for having me here. It's my understanding that the topic today is about policing in America, and it's my hope that my experience and my current role as director at the Golden West Training Center can help add to that conversation and to your listeners and viewers. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Tim. So let's go into our first question. You know, we just got some feedback that Officer Chauvin was charged with guilty on all three cases of assault and murders. So when we look back at the protests at the Black Lives Matter movement, why are these protests calling for police reform? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that policing in America has had a very difficult path. I think that if you look back in its history, there's been a lot of significant cases where the public have seen that there's excessive use of force or police brutality. You can go back even to the 60s during the civil rights, and you can look more recently, about 25, 30 years ago, when the beating of Rodney King was captured on video by. And then that was shown across the world, and obviously the result of the trial that went and the protests that took place. And then if you look at the last 10 years, I think one of the things that changed kind of how we are looking at policing in America has a lot to do with the availability, awareness of what's going on, I believe. And I think that, now with social media, the 24-hour news cycle, a lot of these incidents are being captured and being reported, and consequently, they're now being seen by everybody in the community. And over the last 10 years, we've had a lot of significant incidents involving excessive use of force. And some of them have been difficult to watch, including the killing of George Floyd. And I think that, there's certainly a certain amount of anger in the community. They want some kind of reform. They're hoping that collectively as we move forward to try to look for ways to improve policing, that the deaths of these people that under law enforcement won't be overlooked again. And I think that it's healthy for the country, I think, to have that discussion. I think it's always important that if we see something wrong with our system, I think it's on us to look at it, I think, carefully. But I would also caution that we should look at it with looking at the facts with the goal of what can we do to improve the system? And I think that if we can get together and figure out what that is, I think that bodes well for not only policing, but for our community as well.
Yeah, thank you, Director Tim. I do have a question though. I was wondering if you had any personal experiences where you have seen any, I guess, potential action that might have contributed to the increase in police brutality, as well as anything that you think might, I guess, made it worse, basically. So what's in your past experiences, personal experience, do you think that you've seen that made you kind of like having a more understanding of the current issues that we have with our police?
Well, I think that anytime when you look at any type of profession, especially in policing, I think that you're always going to find certain folks that break policy or break the law. And as far as how long it's been going on, I would probably venture to guess it's probably been going for a while. To what extent, it's hard to say, but being that, you know, you have video evidence now that kind of shows when these incidents are occurring, obviously the advent of the smartphone where everybody now is walking around with the video camera helps to kind of bring to light some of these issues. I think, you know, I've seen some of that in my career in law enforcement, not to the extent that what's being played out in some of the things that we're watching on the news. I think it would be remiss for me to say that it doesn't exist. I think it does. And I think it's important that when we see it exists, that we do what we can to try to hold those accountable. And I think that's what you're seeing now. I certainly saw that in the case of Derek Chauvin.
So I see that you mentioned something about, you know, the current technology has allowed people to have more access to your phones, to be able to have recording devices, which is an interesting topic to bring up, because now a lot of people are calling for police to utilize body cam as a way to have some sort of accountability for their actions. Do you think that that is some reasonable reform for police?
I think it's a step in the right direction. My previous agency, our officers that do wear that when they go out in public and work, they do have body worn cameras. We do use those videos for the purpose of reviewing incidents, whether it's use of force. You know, I would say that a lot of agencies in California have policy when it comes to a report of use of force, in the sense that if an officer in the course of their work, they use force on a member of the public, that use of force must be documented. And then in many cases, a supervisor must investigate that use of force to determine two things. Number one, was the force that was used within policy and training? And if not, then they can investigate further. So there is a lot of checks in place. And as a former chief of police, I would review all of those incidents myself after they've been investigated, and then make a determination. Obviously, if it's a training issue, we try to provide training to our employees. If it's something more than that, then there's possibly appropriate discipline that comes as a result of that. So those checks are in place. And they do exist. The important point is they must continue to be adhered to, in the sense that organization must follow the policy, must have accountability when it comes to uses of force. And the body worn camera, I think you'll see that more and more. I would share that one of the challenges is the expense of those programs. And sometimes for agencies that have budget issues, that might be a challenge for them to bring on a program that, you know, that would employ body-worn cameras. So I think that from a reform perspective, if that's what legislators or community wants law enforcement to have, I think there should be some kind of mechanism to help fund those type of equipment. So that way, regardless if the community can afford it or not, you'll find those cameras in every policing community. And I think that's a direction that we're probably moving in. For a lot of the larger agencies have them in place. Some of the smaller are finding grant money or other ways to get that. But I think over time, you'll see many, many police agencies, if not all, move towards that direction.
So let's take a step back and talk about, you know, racial profiling. And I believe it's the consistent issue that we're seeing a lot in media, how due to the over patrolling in communities of colors, you see a lot more people get charged for offenses that you don't typically see in other communities. But in order to do that, I have to define the racial profiling, which in this case is the use of race and ethnicity as grounds for suspecting someone committed as offense. And it's a good thing that, you know, Nga here has a question that kind of goes along with what I'm about to ask. does the Vietnamese and the Asian American in general suffer from similar racial profiling from police?
No, I think it's such a generalized statement. It's hard for me to say. Let me speak to just my experience. Having worked in communities that have a large Vietnamese American population, I don't know if it's as prevalent as what's being reported in maybe other communities of color. I think that, again, I think it would be unfair for me to say that it doesn't exist. I just don't see it in the same type of intensity that I think it's being reported in other communities. I think where you do see some disparate treatment in the sense that I think that when you have policing services that don't have the ability to, let's say, have a translator or the documents in the language that your residents can read and understand, it's more about an issue of access to services. And I think that sometimes could be part of just as damaging when people in those communities don't know how to access their public safety services due to language barrier or other issues. And so I see that probably being more of a common problem than, say, racial profiling. But again, I guess it probably does exist to a certain degree, but nothing near communities of color.
And I kind of agree with you. It's not as prevalent in other communities of color. But what I do remember, you know, from growing up here, basically, I am afraid to call the police for emergencies, because I think, you know, with the Vietnamese culture and how we're taught to race, especially, you know, when we first came into America, we're scared of authority and we're scared to present any issues that we have to authority. And I believe it has a little bit to do with the language barrier that is prevalent in interactions with any cops and police, or we feel like the sense of danger when we try to interact with someone in power. And I think typically, you know, for the Asian American experience, it's especially for the Vietnamese American experience, you know, we have a lot of fear and pressure when it comes to dealing with authority figure. Okay, so I wanted to bring back, you know, to racial profiling. What are your thoughts on the police over patrolling communities of colors, and what are you hoping to see changes, you know, in the near future?
Well, it depends on what the purpose is. I think when you talk about policing in general in those terms, if the patrolling is done for a purpose to help either to reduce crime or promote community engagement, that's one thing. But when if the quote, over-patrolling results in desperate treatment for a particular group in the community just because of their color of their skin or their socioeconomic issue, and policing use that as a means to possibly enforce laws that they otherwise wouldn't enforce in the community, and that would be the wrong thing. But if it's, you know, again, it's specific to that community, it's my hope that, you know, when we as in policing, when we are out there in the community, it is to do good and not to do harm to the community. And so it's to the extent that there are some communities that want the police officers in the community because of the fear of gangs, the fear of drugs, or other things that are going on. So if there's a legitimate purpose, I believe, for why they should be there, then I think it's helpful. But if it's just there but it doesn't serve any kind of legitimate purpose, then that would be a significant concern for me.
So I'm going to try to copy Chi Bao Chen, where we're going to try to talk about a lot of the different types of police reform policies and whether you think that is something that we should try to implement versus something that you think might not be as successful in the long term. I've been looking at, you know, a lot of different policy and how the different reforms can act. So the first one I would say is we should implement some type of de-escalation training, which is also adopted by a Florida chief, where he reported in a decreased arrest in Volusia County in Florida. And the reason why there was a lot of talks about this training policy is because right now, you know, the current stats showing that a lot of police officers receive less than 10 hours in de-escalation training, while 100 plus hours of combat training. And hopefully, you know, with more training that geared towards de-escalation, you would see less arrests, be able to help the people without causing any permanent harm. What are your thoughts on that?
I think, first of all, I think when it comes to de-escalation training, many agencies already have that as far as part of the training. At the Golden West Police Academy, the recruits are given de-escalation training as part of the use of force training. So we are trying to incorporate de-escalation training more. But I think you pointed out a good point in that there's not enough. And I think that's really where the focus should be, is that moving forward, I think, from a training perspective, I think providing the young men and women that are going to be featured law enforcement professionals more training specific to de-escalation, to where, you know, they can get people to voluntarily comply without ever having to use force, really is the goal of training. And I see that as a direction that I think many academies are going towards, and I think policing in general. And so I think that type of progress is healthy for policing, and it's just my hope that we can get more of it.
The second type of reform that a lot of people are asking for is to have an armed police officer. So this is popular in a lot of European countries. So instead of having guns, you have maces and batons, which are not used unless really required to. So they're basically a lot, some people are calling for, you know, to not give police officer guns, or if you do give guns, give them rubber bullets so that it won't cause permanent damage harm. I mean, the purpose mainly would just to stun the perpetrator, whoever he or she might be, and just provide them some type of like a stunning effect instead of like, you know, a more permanent injuries. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it sounds good in theory, but it's not practical. Okay. The reality is that if you did that, I think that society would be a greater danger than not. Here's the thing. We have almost over 300 million guns in the United States. That's a lot. That's more than any country in the world. And so our streets are already violent. I think if you take away officer's ability to defend herself or himself or members of the public, I think you put the public and the officer at greater risk. The focus should be more about training when to use that force as opposed to taking that option away altogether. And in that, you know, kind of what we talked about, providing additional de-escalation training, officers have other tools on their belt to try to de-escalate, and only to result in the use of force, deadly force, when necessary. In 2019, California became one of the few states in the country that passed a new law that required officers, in the case of deadly force, to make sure that it's reasonable and necessary, which is a legal burden that is much more restrictive than most other states in the country. Part of that, the U.S. Supreme Court that kind of dictates when an officer can use lethal force is Graham v. Conner. And in that, the Supreme Court says that officers are basically faced with making life and death situation in the moment's thing. And it's difficult to try to second guess what an officer would do in that moment. And so the court says, you know, they look at the standard and they said, okay, what would a reasonable officer do given the situation at the time? And that's been a standard for many years. And then more recently, in 2019, California passed a new bill that required for necessary, which is even a higher standard in some cases for the use of lethal force. So I think those type of progress, I think, are measured, and I think goes to addressing the issue that I think the public is concerned about, but not unnecessarily putting officers and the public at risk. I think the notion of taking away guns for officers to go out there and be policing, it's a dangerous proposal, and one that I think could get both the officer and the community in more, I think, in a situation where I don't think we will feel any safer as a result of that. So I know that they pointed other studies in other countries, and it may work in that country, but I think our country is a bit unique in its size and in its challenges.
That makes sense that, you know, since we do have a majority of gun owners that is located in our country, it's also good for the police officers to be able to have some sort of protections for themselves as well. A third reform that I've read about is to have a agency, which is, you know, in a sense called kind of like police watchdogs. And basically what they do is they would handle all mishandling cases. So anything that involves any type of police brutality or any types of basically any violence that ensue with any cases. So they'll be able to fact check and or keep police officers accountable for any of their actions. What are your thoughts about forming an agency similar to that?
Well, I think that the topic of police reform really got a lot of wind because of the instance where deadly force has taken place. If you look at most of the incidents that's been reported, it usually involves the use of deadly force on a member of the public. In California last year, the legislature passed a new law, or a law that really gives the authority to the Attorney General's office to investigate police shootings involving unarmed citizens. So it's going to take effect this July once the state funds that program. But essentially what the program will do is it allows the investigators from the Attorney General's office to go anywhere in the state when there is a shooting of an unarmed citizen by the police. And the hope is that the investigation will be transparent, will be impartial, and then whatever the findings of those cases are, it will be reviewed by the Attorney General's office to make a determination what action is appropriate from there. And having said that, all the other uses of force cases that don't rise to that level are investigated. If you look at, it's in Orange County where you reside now, many of the agencies, when there is an officer-involved shooting, the district attorney's office will come out and investigate the shooting, not the police department. They will handle a certain aspect of it, but with respect to whether or not the use of force by the officer, which in this case, the shooting by the officer, whether or not it was legal or not, that determination is being made by the district attorney's office, independent of the police department. And so, and the hope is that those investigations are impartial, they're independent, they're done by the prosecutor's office, and that will give the public a sense that, you know, someone else is investigating. Regards to all types of disciplinary cases that may rise to that, some of the larger agencies have that. They have a kind of citizen oversight committee that looks into those type of complaint. I can see that becoming more of a trend moving forward in policing, where you'll have an independent body that looks at, you know, police misconduct. And so, again, I think it's just a matter of time before that happens. But I think that, you know, it's really going to come down to, and like everything else, budget and cost, and whether or not you can be able to fund those programs. But if you're able to, if that's what the community wants, if they have a funding for that, I think that's an opportunity for the community at least to have some kind of assurances that, you know, there's an independent party or body that's reviewing these incidents to make sure that the action on the part of the officers are appropriate or not. And if they're not appropriate, then, you know, they should be brought to the proper agency for disposition.
So on to the next point. During the protests, a lot of people have signs that says, you know, defund the police. And it's interesting that they say that, but I think there is actually more to that. You know, instead of just defunding the police wholeheartedly, what a lot of people are calling for is to cut some of the police funding in order to give into community support programs. So some of those would be, you know, reduce policing contact by actually dealing with the homelessness crisis, as well as any drug abuse, any mental health, and these should be handled by experts. So they're calling to cut some of the police funding in order to move it towards programs. Like, for example, homelessness, there have been studies that indicates that when you build a home for people in the homelessness, it's helped getting them off the street. Plus it's cheaper for the community in order to establish a facility for the homeless people to come and live, have a permanent address, and then be able to find jobs. For drugs abuse people, they also, again, establish a facility where people can learn over time in order to wean themselves off any drugs, as well as have a safe place to be able to revitalize them if they, in any case, overdose. And I believe it was a program that was in Canada that established something like that, and they have seen a lot of improvements. And from there also have the mental health aspect where, you know, when someone is in like a very stressful response, they have any type of mental disorders, instead of the police coming, you can have ambulance of psychiatric nurses as well as paramedics that can respond specifically to the mental health issues. So shift that focus away from police officers, because police officers won't be able to have the capacity to be able to handle that situation, or I believe know how to properly de-escalate the program without knowing, you know, what the mental health person is coming to. And I think that it's a program, I believe, from the Swedish justice system that just shifts more towards community programs. But in the end, that it is quite expensive, you know, in order to maintain. And I just wanted to kind of like have a good understanding on it a little bit more. So what are your thoughts on that one?
I think it's always good to look at new ways of possibly trying to solve the issue of, you know, the two issues that you pointed out, which is the large issue of homelessness and substance abuse. And I think that that's a challenge that every community is facing. I can tell you that for the most part, most policing agencies don't want to deal with it. But more often than not, they're asked to deal with the problem. And, you know, the challenge with policing in general is that they're one of the very few agencies in most municipalities that provide 24/7 service. And what consequently happens is that usually a lot of these calls that come in, there's a need for a timely and immediate response. So the challenge is trying to get, you know, the right people out to those situation as quickly as possible, especially when we're dealing with someone that are in crisis that need immediate attention. And so if we're able to set up resources that can respond in a timely manner to get to those critical incident and where it doesn't necessitate a police response, I think that is the right approach. I think that my concern only is going to be whether or not there's going to be enough funding to support that, because even if you take a certain amount of funding from policing, there are still other policing matters that still needs to take care of. And so, you know, in moving some of that budget from policing to do some of that, what is policing not going to be able to do because the budget has been cut? So I think whatever the approach is going to be, it has to be measured. It's got to be really well thought out to make sure that it has its desired and intended outcome. My only concern is that there's a rush to try to push on these programs that may work in other communities. And you can always point to a program that works well here, but you know, one program working well somewhere does not necessarily mean that it becomes a silver bullet necessarily for everything. So I would only caution that I think it's good that we're looking at different ways to try to solve this problem, because continuing to doing the same way that we've been doing for the last 10, 15 years clearly is not the solution. So I think that when we find programs that are successful, it's my hope that we incorporate here, that we're measured in our implementation of the program just to make sure that, you know, it's designed and it's giving us the outcomes that we want it to give without unnecessarily creating more harm than good to the program, and then at the same time really making it difficult for the policing departments to fulfill their other mission as well. So I think that it really has to be measured when it comes to that. But I can tell you, generally speaking, over time, these problems have really been born out of just a lack of other services out there. And that's why these people are where they're at. And then consequently, when they're out on the street, they become a challenge for the community. And consequently, law enforcement's called in to try to solve. But you're correct in pointing out, it's not a policing matter. It really isn't. Our ability really is just to try to the extent that we can make the situation safe when we can, and then try to direct them to the right resources.
So I think this is the last one. If I come up with any more, I will let you know. But there have been some people that also call for an increase in education in order to become a police officer. So there's some studies that show that, you know, police officers that have more than 4 years of education or a degree, you say, in the criminal justice system, receive less complaints from the community, as well as uses 40% reduction in the uses of force. So what a lot of people are calling for is to, in order just to have like a basic training of like less than a year, you require the police officers to undergo training, understanding psychology, understanding different community, understanding the history, and then from there, teach a lot of de-escalation methods, and then have them to be able to participate in the community to build trust and connection. So what are your thoughts on that reform?
Well, I take that question in two areas. One, you're talking about more training for the police recruits to have before they go out to the police department. I think that's a I think that's a discussion that we certainly should consider. It's the challenge of the profession has become increasingly complex. And so I think providing more training for the recruits, I think, can only enhance their ability to be effective in the pacing of the community. Now, if we're talking about whether or not they need to get a bachelor's degree before going into law enforcement, that might be a different challenge too, only because it's already difficult right now for many of these agencies to recruit people into public safety as it is. And I think that the more requirements and as we increase the requirements for that, we then restrict the pool of potential applicants even more so than they are now, which will create even a greater challenge for communities to recruit and to hire a police professional. So I think that's my biggest concern would be how much will that impact the ability for agencies to recruit and replace their staffing as the attrition for retirement or for other reasons. So I think education is good. I'm only concerned about is if we could make it more restrictive, how difficult will it be for agencies that are already struggling with recruiting even more so. And if you talk about that too, like there's been talk about whether or not you increase to possibly a bachelor's degree. We talk about equity a lot in policing too, right? And in terms of making sure, and the other thing about having people that are from that community, police be part of that policing community. You know, when you look at equity, you look at policing, you know, minorities and people of color are those that are a lot of times disenfranchised in terms of getting that four-year degree. So now if you make it even more restrictive in terms of education requirement, are you then consequently making it more difficult for those people in those communities to be part of the policing in their own community? Because now you've raised that bar now. And if you look statistically, again, those that are from a lower socioeconomic background tends to have a greater challenge as far as getting that four-year degree. So I think that, again, I understand the discussion behind that, but my concern is that the unintended consequences of limiting access for folks that are in this community to want to be part of the solution of policing the community, now it's even more of a challenge because they don't have a degree or the ability to go get that because of personal reasons or financial reasons. So again, I think it's an idea worth looking into, but I think we want to make sure that we don't exclude more people in the process as we do that.
So that might have been all my suggestions for reforms. I was wondering, what are your thoughts, you know, on the current police state, and what are some reforms that you would actually suggest in order to improve and prevent any types of police brutality in the future?
Well, I think it always starts with training. I think that we certainly should look at increasing the amount of training that officers receive. So not only once they get in, but while they're in the profession. So currently right now in the state, officers are only required to receive about, I believe, 12 hours of what's called perishable skills training, which is skills that require like psychomotor type of movement, whether it be the arrest and control or other things. And so 12 hours of training over the course of 2 years while on the job is really not that much. So I think that we really should look at enhancing and increasing the amount of training that police professional gets, especially those that are working in patrol on the streets that have the direct contact with members of the community. Maybe as a result of budget, we don't necessarily need to make everybody, but really anybody that has kind of that point of contact with members of the community, I think those individuals probably should have more training to help improve their ability to de-escalate when appropriate in situations like that. And I think with regards to reform, one of the other issues here is who we bring on, right? I think that if you properly vet someone to make sure that they are who we want to bring into the profession, an example would be just recently when my previous department started looking at when we do background checks on people, we also look at any possible implicit biases that he or she might have had as part of that background. So I think that looking to try to weed out any type of biases or any type of racist type of behavior or belief in potential police applicant, I think is important. And then the psychological screening that takes place. I mean, most police applicants must go through a psychological screening, but most police department, after he or she is in the department, don't have any kind of follow-up psychological evaluation. That may be something that I think the expert might have to consider, because I think once you do the profession long enough, you might start off, you know, with all the right virtues and values, but over time, as you're exposed to a lot of bad things out there, who's to say that those type of bad things that he or she is being exposed to doesn't change himself or herself in some way that has a very negative consequence? And so maybe having periodic psychological screening of individuals to try to identify early on if they have those problems, and with the goal of trying to give them the best treatment or assessment, so that they don't go down that path of what you see being displayed out on some of these very bad excessive use of force that's being played out in the media. And so I think there are opportunities there, I think, for us to look at as a community to figure out what we can do to. And the goal really should be is that to train and give all these folks that are out there protecting our community all the best tools possible so that they can do their job well under the law and to keep us all safe.
It's interesting that you brought up a lot that, you know, we need the people, we need more people, you know, to kind of like join the police force and have regular proper background checks as well, which is something I've been thinking about. You know, will the police culture improve if we try to get more people of color? It's like for the Vietnamese American people in general, you know, if there is more Vietnamese officers, then do you think our community will feel much safer?
The short answer is yes. I know that from my experience working previously that, you know, when someone in the Vietnamese American community, especially someone who doesn't speak the language or newly arrived into the country, have a lot of trepidation and a lot of concern about just dealing with policing in general because their experiences in their homeland. And consequently, they carry those same fears with them here. When they call or when they're a victim of a crime, sometimes they hesitate to call just because they don't know if their concern is going to be properly addressed. They don't know if they can accurately convey what they're dealing with. And then when the officer that comes to talk to them don't understand them or don't speak the language, they have a very difficult time communicating what is it they need. And consequently, you know, if the person who's in help, who needs help, can't accurately convey what he or she wants, that puts that whole contact at a disadvantage because that person, the officer that doesn't understand the language or the culture, won't be able to fully provide that level of service because of the cultural difference and the language difference. So having officers that understand those cultural nuances and more importantly, the language, I think helps bridge that gap for the community and the department. So I think it is helpful. The challenge is trying to get those folks into policing. And, you know, a lot of folks have, again, like you pointed out, have a very negative impression of law enforcement. So when their children want to try to pursue that, they're normally dissuaded from pursuing that as a career choice. And usually they're pointed into a different profession as opposed to law enforcement. So I think that makes it more challenging because, you know, because of the stereotype that comes with what policing is and policing isn't, makes it that difficult for us to recruit young men and women of the Vietnamese American into policing. So hopefully, even with this law of shame here, that people recognize, okay, there's someone that's done it before and doesn't seem half bad, but maybe they might pursue that. And that's what we offer at Golden Wise as a director of criminal justice. Obviously, you know, for the young students that want to pursue law enforcement, they can certainly go to Golden Wise, get their criminal justice degree, and potentially enroll into the police academy to part of the solution. And I really see that that's how we move this conversation forward, in that it is much better to be part of the system to change it from the inside than from the outside. And because I think that when you're on the inside, I think you have a better perspective of what it is and what it isn't. And you're able to be part of those policy decisions. And I think it's also helpful to see more of Vietnamese American position of leadership so that their perspectives and their point of view can be part of the discussion when policies are being made. And I think that in the long term, I think that will help the Vietnamese American community. But if we don't have policymakers that understand those cultural nuances and challenges, then we don't have a full voice at the table when there's policy, whatever the situation. It could be policing, it could be fire service, it could be whatever. But I think anytime when you have people that have that understanding, I think adds to the conversation. And I think that it's healthy that when you have policymakers that have more information on issues affecting their constituents, hopefully they can make a better and more well-informed decision as it relates to their policies. So I think whether folks want to get law enforcement or not, I think the only way that we can bridge that gap is to try to encourage more folks to be part of the system.
And it's great to be able to hear that you can say that, which hopefully encourage a lot of young people, you know, who were originally afraid of the law enforcement department to kind of like pull up their bootstraps and go and try to make the changes themselves. But I'll proceed to the next question. And Hui here actually has a question, the exact question that I was about to ask next, which he asked, you know, what do you think about allowing citizens to sue the police? And would that maybe have some accountability for the police officers? And the reason why I think this question is kind of important, because right now the current law says that you, in order for you to sue, you need to have really proved that they have violated your rights through a clearly established method. But in order for it to be clearly established, there has to be a lawsuit about it beforehand. So it's the same question as the, you know, trying to get your first job, but you need previous experience, or you know, the chicken and the egg kind of story. So I wanted to kind of like see what your thoughts are on this question. So what do you think, you know, allowing people to sue, would that help stop police brutality?
Well, I think to the question, the answer is yes. Members of the community can sue the police if they choose to. That's always been the case, and that hasn't changed. I think to your point, it's about what does it take for them to win a lawsuit, and that really comes down to whether or not, you know, if a police officer in the course of their employment they are doing their job, then they have certain amount of protection. Now, obviously, if they're not doing their job, meaning they're violating the law or they're acting in a certain negligent or reckless way, they can be held personally liable for that. But yeah, but to answer Lee's question, yes, citizens can sue the police. They've always been able to sue the police. So it's just a matter of what type of police do they have and whether or not the officers did violate their right. Can they prove that in court? And certainly now with the addition of smartphones and body-worn cameras, there's videos out there. Certainly there's a case to be made that the officer is violating someone's right. I think probably now more than ever, people have at least the ability, if that was the case, to prove that in the court of law. And to the second part of whether or not that would help stop policing brutality, I don't know whether that would or not. I guess my point is, I think that anytime you have a lawsuit and as a result of that decision, I think, especially if it's a good case, I hope that as a result of that, policies would change, especially if it's to identify a bad policy that an organization is implementing that's resulting in harm to a member of the community. I think it's in those cases that lawsuits will help to try to change those policies for the good. And I think to that extent, it would be helpful. So Derek Chauvin's conviction, the Attorney General reported shortly after that they'll be looking into the Minneapolis Police Department. And hopefully through that review by the Justice Department, if they come across other practices that are deemed not appropriate, unlawful, or a harm to the community, that they can change those practices and make the department better moving forward for everyone. So that's my hope that comes out from that. If they do identify different practices that are harmful, that they can correct those harms. So that kind of, to the second question that he has, is that will it help? So you have the Derek Chauvin case, which was a conviction. Now you have the Attorney General's office on looking into that department to determine if the policies and rules are what it should be. And so we'll see after they have a chance to do a thorough analysis and review of that department's practices, customs, and culture, to see what, if any, changes that they were recommending. And generally, those situations happen is usually if the Justice Department finds a violation of the law, there'll be a consent decree, probably an agreement between the Justice Department and that police department there on what reforms would take place at that department moving forward. Similar to what we saw here in Los Angeles when, after the Rodney King, the Los Angeles Police Department was under a consent decree and they had to follow certain rules specific to them as a result of that negotiation between them and the Justice Department.
So the other questions that I have, hopefully it's kind of a little bit of the last one, but how would you improve the police community relations, and can the community-oriented policing reduce the conflict between law enforcement services and the police? The reason why, I think this question is kind of important because I think a lot of people champion that the mistrust between the community and the police is due to the lack of involvement for a lot of officers in their community. So, interaction with the kids, coming out to community events, be able to make relations with these people will help, first of all, the community to trust the police more, while also help the police to see the community as someone that they can protect. So what are your thoughts on that one?
My thought is I couldn't agree more. I think that it's vital in today's society that all police departments should be actively engaging in community policing, and that really make that the core of their policing strategy. At the end of the day, policing is nothing more than a public service to the community. And like in any business, you really need to know who you're serving. And you're only going to be able to do that is by having that engagement and that contact. So I think that in the situations that you typically see where there's a lot of strife between policing and the community, my guess would be that there hasn't been a lot of dialogue between the police department and the members of the community. And it got to a point where an incident happened and it boiled over and we saw what we saw. So I do think that it's vital that any police department out there should be engaging actively in community policing. And what does that mean? And to your extent, it really is just about getting officers out of their car and being in those community affairs, providing for opportunities where members of the community can engage members of the police department to understand what the policing department does and what it doesn't do. And then, like you said, to have those police officers get familiar with, who they serve in the community. I always tell people it's harder for you to not like someone you know, meaning that if you build a relationship with people and you get to know them by name, you will naturally build a certain amount of trust and respect for that other person because you know who they are. When we don't have that and when we keep to ourselves, I think that's, and we don't know the other individual, that's usually where misunderstanding takes place. And as a result, those misunderstandings could have very deadly consequences in some cases. So getting out there and, having officers being a part of the community is vital. And I think a lot of departments are doing that to some degree. I think they can be better at it using social media. Certainly COVID made it very difficult in this past year because, the traditional events that police departments would have, whether it be your coffee with a cop or your different type of events that would allow for the interaction between members of the community, that's really been difficult under COVID. But I've also seen a lot of departments use virtual meetings to try to continue on that. Certainly it's different than a in-person type of environment. But I really think as we come out of COVID, as we start to open up our society a little more, and the George Floyd killing took place during COVID, and the trial took place during COVID, so we had this very significant event in our nation's history in terms of policing, all taking place under this pandemic. It will be interesting to see how communities and their respective department move forward as we open up a little bit more, what that engagement's going to be like with members of the community and their department. And I'm just hoping that all of our policing communities are planning for that to try to figure out how they can engage their community to start building back that trust that was lost over the course of this past year, and really have a lot of humility in the process to recognize that they can do better and willing to listen to your community and figure out what is it they need to do to be better. And I think that if they start having that dialogue, I think that will bode well both for the department and the community.
Thank you, Director Tim, for your really great input. I wholeheartedly agree. And hopefully, you know, we can repair the relationship and build that trust in the community, which is, you know, really important for everyone to feel safe and comfortable in their daily lives. Oh, so we have a question here from, yeah, we're going to turn a little bit more personal, if that's okay with you. I think the audience wants to know, you know, why did you decide to work in the law enforcement, and maybe some perspective that you can give to our audience?
Okay. I think, so I grew up mostly in Orange County, and I initially was, I think like many Asian Americans, had an interest in biology, and my initial thought was to major in bio, maybe be a chiropractor. And what got me into law enforcement was after high school, I had a summer job as an intern at the Gardenville Police Department, and I had that interaction with other people in law enforcement, and that's where my interest in law enforcement began. And I think that if you look at the Asian American community, I think a lot of young men and women don't have a family member or that connection to law enforcement, so that's not very something that they thought as a career choice. Fortunately for me, I happened to take a summer job at a police department, and that's what sparked my interest. And so after I got my associate's degree, I started applying for different police departments and started my career at San Diego Police Department. And shortly after that, I went to the Westminster Police Department, where I spent the bulk of my law enforcement career there in the city of Westminster for about 23 years. And then I went on to Alhambra, where I served as chief there for 4 years. It's been a great career for me, and I think that it exposed me to a lot of things I think that I would otherwise be exposed to. I would recommend it for those that are out there that are thinking about it. Certainly, you can always drop me an email or something that I can always share more of my thoughts on that. But I do want to encourage you to think about it as a career choice. That's a great way to serve your community. You know, policing is one of the most visible forms of government, in that, you know, that's what many people see as those officers are driving on, or the fire department. So it's a great way for folks to interact with the community, to serve. And if that's what they're passionate about, then I think they should look at that as a good choice. And it has its excitement, but I would say that the bulk of the work is really about helping people solve their problems. And if that's something that people are interested in, then public safety is certainly something that you consider.
Thank you now for the question. So, you know, we're heading almost, you know, to near the end. And honestly, I think, you know, today's conversation has been so informative for both me and I believe our audience. Definitely, I never actually thought about, you know, as Asian Americans, I, you know, from personal experiences, our goal path in life is always doctor, lawyer, some anything in the STEM field. And we don't really put a lot of like thoughts into the law enforcement field, because I think, you know, growing up as Asian Americans, we are kind of trained to be scared of the police department, especially because there is no representation of us. And the only way to change that if there is more of us, right? So what you recommended about more people in the community joining the police department and thereby providing a safe space where you're able to feel more comfortable to interact with, you know, authority figures should allow you to feel a lot more comfortable, because there would be a lack of a language barrier, and, you know, there would be a lot more trust in the community, you know, with all the programs we're planning, like hopefully our city is planning to initiate, as well as the more education that requires for incoming police officers in order to kind of like build more awareness when it comes to social issues and mental health and things that, you know, a lot of the people in the community are very present about. Do you have any last words to Director Tim before we end the live stream for today?
I just want to say, Fawn, thank you for the opportunity to kind of share a little bit about my thoughts on the policing in general. And I think that it's important. I think anytime when a topic as important as this, I think it comes up, especially how it affects, I think, all of our lives. I think the fact that your listeners are listening in on this topic is a good step in. So I just encourage them to continue to pursue and learn more about it. And I think the more people that understand what it is, and more importantly, what it isn't, I think that helps all of us collectively. So thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. It's been 1 hour, which means I will head out. Thank you for joining the Come Live Home Mid broadcast, and we will see you guys again next week. Bye.